welcome to Talk is Jericho. It's the Pod of Thunder and Rock and Roll, and it's all about The Rock today as we dive into a new documentary about a musician and an artist who has had a huge influence on my own career. One of my all-time favorites, right up there with the Beatles and the Stones. And if you've seen the new ink on my upper left arm, then you know what I'm talking about, the late, great David Bowie. There's a new documentary out about him called Loving the Alien. Trailer is already up on Vimeo, and the doc is coming on June 2nd. Just search Loving the Alien documentary, and you'll find it. So today I've got the filmmaker and fellow Bowie fanatic, Maurice Hovan, on the show. He's going to talk about all things late-career Bowie. Maurice hosts the Cat Named Mo show weeknights on 102.5 The Bone in Tampa. He spent the better part of 6 months producing and directing this documentary. It's all existing footage and includes some really rare and hard-to-find moments from David's later career, the post-Less Dance era, like the jam session with the Foo Fighters from his first 50th birthday concert at Madison Square Garden, some of the funny bits he did with British comedian and actor Ricky Gervais. We talk about Bowie's last album, one of my all-time favorites, Black Star, and his last persona, the Blind Prophet, or Button Eye, who appears in the videos for Black Star and Lazarus. Bowie was so innovative and creative right up until his death. We really get into that, the constant reinvention, the music experimentation, and why he stopped touring in 2004. It's Maurice Hovan talking about Loving the Alien, all about David Bowie, the genius, right here on Talk is Jericho. So with the amazing world of social media and Twitter, I met Maurice Hovan.
Maurice Hovan. Yeah,
Maurice Hovan. Okay,
that's good.
And I had no idea that you actually live in Tampa as well.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And you are on air at
102.5 The Bone. I'm part of that lineup, which has Mike Calta in the mornings, Roger and JP, Drew Garabo, and then my show, The Cat Named Mo Show, follows.
Awesome. So I was looking at it, and somehow, I don't know if you contacted me, if I just happened to see that Maurice had done a documentary.
I was just going
to
say, I can tell you exactly how
tell
it
me.
Happened. Yeah, someone had retweeted that massive Bowie tattoo that you have on. Yeah, there it is. And I had no idea you were a Bowie fan. And I reached out to you to come to the premiere of my Bowie documentary.
Right.
And you DM'd me and said, I'll do you one better. Let's talk on my podcast, which I was ecstatic about.
Which is great because Bowie over time is I've always been a huge fan, but he's slowly becoming maybe my favorite artist of all time. And you got to keep in mind that I'm a huge Beatles fanatic and Stones fanatic. And,
okay. You
know, of course, Metallica and Maiden and all that sort of thing. But I've basically based my own career on the concept of what Bowie did with his career, which is constantly evolving, constantly updating who he was as a singer, as a character, his style of music.
Right.
And
right.
So I really have been having a great appreciation for Bowie over the last 5 or 6 years, especially for the last few records of his life, more specifically Black Star, which to me it might be my favorite album of all time. And we'll get into that. I'll say one last statement, then I'll turn it over to you. And when I saw you're doing a Bowie documentary, which was great, I was like, oh my goodness, he's focusing on the, like you said, post Let's Dance stage of his career, which just I thought was such an interesting way to do it.
Lionheart, if I could call you that.
That's Mr. Hart to you, please.
Mr. Hart. Let me say one thing and one thing first. I did not get any Fozzy merch, so what I did was I put on my Black Label Society Dickie, hand given to me by one Mr. Zach Wild when I got to interview him up in Columbus, Ohio.
Father Maurice.
Yeah, and I know that he played on a couple of tracks of Fozzy's.
He did.
This is what I would say. It's very interesting that you talk about you modeling your career after, Bowie, because, you know, wanting to do the due diligence and do the research, obviously, Chris Jericho, I know you, I know of you, I am aware of what you represent in wrestling, you know, maybe one of the greatest, if not the greatest. It's not for me to say, but I'm not afraid to say it.
Thank you.
Then I started looking into all of the other things that you've done, singing, acting, playing, creating, and what you have that separates you from a lot of other cats in the game is the fact that someone could technically refer to you as a Renaissance man. And if you talk about Renaissance men, Bowie was the prototypical Renaissance man,
right,
from being a Broadway actor to a screen actor to an artist, a multi-instrumentalist, a singer-songwriter. He was not comfortable staying in one space. That's kind of the appeal of him for me too, Chris, because aside from radio, I did radio. I still do it, but I did radio and started in radio and stand-up concurrently, decided that I wanted to write a novel. Filmmaking has always been my passion from a very early age, and I decided to pursue that as early as I could and as often as I could. So seeing someone like David Bowie, who was constantly evolving, but also constantly staying true to himself, which could absolutely be said about you, that was my guy. Plus, it's the, I'm not going to curse, it's the effing music. I mean, the music is brilliant. And you mentioned Black Star. How often does an artist get to write his own epitaph? I don't think that's ever happened in rock. I don't think there's ever been a rock artist that spans five decades of music and hits that 6 months before he dies begins recording, perhaps, as you say, his best work. It's certainly his most complex work. And it releases the day after he dies. And he was at the precipice of 70. Who's doing that? You mentioned the Stones. I love the Stones. But, you know, they've been touring off of the hits for quite some time. And Bowie, he was just not satisfied doing that.
No, and that's what I think is so cool of the concept of this. And also, too, mentioning Black Star in the fact that, like you mentioned, he was doing this record while he knew he was dying and creates another amazing character in, you know, the Button-Eyed, the Lost Prophet Button-Eye, which is so creepy when you first see it. It's absolutely nuts. Also, too, the fact that he once again experiments, like it wasn't like Bowie, like, okay, I'm going to go down with the nostalgia thing. He wanted to do a jazz-influenced rock record.
Absolutely.
So instead of having his guys, the Carlos Alomars and the Earl Slicks, etc., play jazz, he hired jazz musicians to play rock and roll.
Come in there. I mean, how brilliant is that?
And it's so simple. But it's also such a Bowie characteristic. And the fact that he made this while he was dying, and I don't even know if you've noticed this, I'm sure you have. The second song is called "Tis a Pity She Was a Whore."
It's a whore. Tis a pity
she was a whore. How does it start? Yeah. It starts with him breathing.
Yes.
He records himself breathing as he's dying. And it's just like, it's so genius. Now, is it his best work? It's hard to compete with, you know, the glory days of Ziggy and even the Let's Dance record and, you know, the Berlin years, etc. But it's kind of like the new Metallica record. It's the best you could possibly ask for Bowie at 70 years old, still rewriting the rules of everything that he did. And then, of course, dying the day the record came out or the day after it came out or the day before.
The day
it came
after,
out.
Right.
Day after, yeah, day after it came out. So we never got a chance to see any of these performances live other than the videos that he did.
Right.
And it's a shame because I would go see Bowie if he, you know, if there was a time frame, and you'll talk about this, where he just refused to play any of his hits and just said, okay, I'm going to start Tin Machine. If he did that with Black Star, I would be there in the front row.
100%. And when you talk about Black Star, Chris, and your knowledge of him, it really impresses me. You have to go back a couple of years to The Next Day where he, well, I think The Next Day really set the stage for Black Star. Black Star, far more complex than The Next Day, but still in that same vein where he had jazz influences and a lot of experimental kind of melodies and pacing. Have you seen Moon Age Daydream?
I have.
Thoughts?
Okay, well, let me do you one better before I talk about Moon Age Daydream.
Okay.
I find your movie, which it's called Loving the Alien. Loving the Alien. It's a great companion piece to a riveting documentary called Bowie, The Last Five Years.
5 years, correct.
Yeah.
Yes.
So it's the last 5 years of his life and talks about kind of the deterioration, all the things that led to him doing The Last Day, doing the Broadway musical, really becoming an artist, doing Black Star as he's dying, and also the Broadway play that he wrote and directed while he was dying. So I think a lot of people don't understand just how great his work was in those later years, right?
Right.
So
right.
when you get a chance to see that, it was called Lazarus.
Lazarus, there you go. Lazarus, correct.
Which, of course, fits. you see just like he, and you mentioned the Stones. We love the Stones. As a matter of fact, I heard the Stones postponed their tour this summer because they want to finish the record. And that's great. Put out a new record, but nobody really had, you know, if you go out of those longtime amazing artists from Elton to The Who to whatever, McCartney, they're putting out stuff, but Bowie's stuff was still vital and it was still great. And I think people forget that or might not even know that.
Absolutely.
Because they just want to hear the 70s and 80s tunes. And you're really missing out if you're a Bowie fan, not listening to the last, you know, few years of his career.
Absolutely. And I would say the documentary spans a 25-year period, though there are gaps in between the records, starting with Tin Machine, which I believe was the album that got him into becoming David Bowie. I think one of the taglines on the trailer is Aladdin Sane, Ziggy Stardust, the Thin White Duke. These were all Bowie personas, the man that made the world dance. Afterwards, Bowie decided to become Bowie. And that was when he, those years, starting with Tin Machine, he stripped away personas. He stripped away artifice. He just stood on stage and became a modern rocker. And there's the album start from Tin Machine and they go through. I kind of bookend with Next Day and Black Star, but really then ends with Reality. So in between there, you have Tin Machine, you have Outside, you have Earthling, Black Tie, White Noise, Heathen, and then Reality. And those seven records, those seven records to me contain some of his most brilliant work. You said you don't know if Black Star could compete with the 70s icon heydays, the Ziggy Stardust, the Diamond Dogs. I think it's weird. What's frustrating about David Bowie is he was such a genre hopper, and not a genre hopper because he was dissatisfied with what he was doing, but because once he perfected something, he wanted to challenge himself, and he addresses that in the documentary himself. So you could find someone that loves Bowie, that is a huge Bowie fan. And then as you say, you start talking about his later works and they're like, he released an album after Let's Dance?
Yeah.
And you're like, he released nine after Let's Dance. but they were not what you loved over here.
Well, because we didn't hear them. It's you know, I'm obviously a gigantic music fan. It's like people who discount 80s Kiss,
oh, absolutely.
80s Rush. It's like, well,
80s Aerosmith.
80s Aerosmith, 80s ZZ Top. Well, you know, ZZ Top turned electronic, or when Rush started getting keyboards, it's like Kiss was too poppy. Like, if you don't listen to those, if you have a favorite band and you discount a whole section of their career just because it's not the original, then you're not a real fan of the band. You know, people bag on Van Halen 3. Like, I listened to that record. Is it my favorite? No, but if I love Eddie Van Halen, there is a reason why he deemed this good enough to release. So I'm going to check it out and listen to it.
And arguably, Gary Cherone may have been the best vocalist out of the three of them, out of Hagar and Ross.
Well, sure, it's just not the glory years that we grew up on, right? So that was my point. If you're talking about Bowie and, you know, you love Les Dance and you love Ziggy and you love Aladdin and all that sort of stuff, Thin White Duke,
right?
You might have grown out of the Bowie, but if you are a Bowie fan, he never stopped being Bowie. And it's not like he just started releasing shitty albums or something, because this stuff is great. So that's why I loved your interpretation of his career. Talking about Moon Age Daydream, I thought it was a little bit of a letdown for me, and I'll tell you the reason why. Really, really enjoyed the last 5 years. I was really into that. Now, I understand Moon Age. It went all around. It's very eclectic, and there's cartoons, and there's, you know, a lot of Bowie as an artist and all that sort of stuff. I just thought it was kind of all over the place, which I guess kind of mirrors Bowie's career, but Bowie's career never seemed all over the place to me. Now, what did you think of Moon Age Daydream?
It's so funny to say, okay, I had buyer's remorse with Moon Age Daydream. I saw Moon Age Daydream and I saw it with my 13-year-old boy. So that's a fantastic experience in and of itself.
Gotcha.
I loved it. But almost immediately after walking out, I said, well, that wasn't enough. I mean, here we are talking about a documentary I'm doing on 8 to 9 albums in a certain era. None of the songs in my documentary, none of them appears in Moon Age Daydreams. It seems like he stopped at Let's Dance. He gave a cursory kind of mention to maybe some other, he just played snippets of music, but he never really talked about the artist that he became. I felt it was a little too expansive.
Right.
What it did brilliantly was it gave you the portrait of an artist that became a work of art. But now, if you didn't love Bowie and you went in there trying to understand Bowie, you were fucked. Mm. you were going to go, okay, I see that he did a lot of stuff, but you know, what else did he do? You can't stop at 80s Bowie in a documentary that's 2.5 hours long and purport to give a comprehensive overview of the man's life.
Right.
But now, Bowie fans, we're all notoriously hard to satisfy. We all want something different, I guess. So I think Brett Morgan did a fantastic job. But I'm like you. I felt wanting more. And I did love, I think, the best documentary that I've seen on him outside of mine, but I'm not saying that, is the last 5 years.
Let me ask you this before we get into Loving the Alien, Maurice, is you keep mentioning that after Tin Machine, which for people that don't know, basically Bowie in 87 or so
around, yeah,
said, right, I'm done being Bowie, no more stadium tours, no more hits. I'm not singing, you know,
China Girl.
Yeah, China Girl or Ground Control to Major Tom ever again. Yeah. And he completely flipped the script and basically formed a hard rock band called Tin Machine, which people, I don't really know if they embraced it, but it's actually really fucking great.
Oh, it's absolutely fantastic. Reeves Gabrel on guitar. He was a very avant-garde guitarist, and I think he carried him through about 4 more records.
Yeah.
Of course, he had the Sales brothers as well, who were Soupy Sales sons. That seemed a little sketchy to me, but whatever.
But yeah, so classic Bowie, right? But my question is, you said that's when he became David Bowie. What do you mean by that?
I mean, and I think that there's an interview where someone asked him about, you know, Ziggy Stardust and the costume and everything. And he goes, oh, so you were playing a character. And he goes, exactly. Understand. And I'm not saying understand to you because you do. And I think a lot of people do. The music was authentic. The music was groundbreaking and it was revolutionary.
Right.
But I think what he was doing was so different that he hid himself behind, you know, makeup, behind these incredibly ornate fashion pieces and whatever. Now, when you talk about Tin Machine, the man's like, even with Let's Dance, he kind of hid himself behind. Remember, he had the platinum blonde dude, and then with the blue jean video, he was all in day. He was still hiding. He was still.
Yeah.
Now, from Tin Machine on, you saw David Bowie in a suit, and that was it. He was done hiding behind anything, and he stood right in front of the music and said, this is me and this is the music that he was always, for me, you know, going into, developing into. My favorite album, Outside, the double album Outside, which is the concept album about a serial killer, and I think probably for me his most fascinating work. So
what year was that?
Outside, I want to say, was 95. Don't hold me to that. But it had Hollow Space Boy. It had The Heart's Filthy Lesson,
gotcha,
which was the end song on David Fincher's 7.
Wow, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Was I right about 95? I think.
Just checking right now. But yeah, it was around that time frame. Once again, kind of in the, if you're not a Bowie fanatic, Outside was 95. Yeah,
okay, for sure. All right.
I think it's funny because I'm looking through his discography. I've never even heard of this one, The Buddha of Suburbia.
Dude.
I don't even know that one. See?
Oh my God. Chris, give me a minute and a half.
All right.
The Buddha of Suburbia was some British television series, ran for a couple years. I had no idea of it whatsoever either. I don't know how I came across a track from it. And then I went into the album. It's reminiscent of his work with Brian Eno. There's some very ethereal tracks on there. There's a couple of instrumentals on there. He actually re-recorded Strangers When We Meet from that album and put it on Outside. It's a better version on Outside. But I will tell you this. If you're on a plane and you've got headphones, you've just got some time and you're a busy man and there's nobody in your ear, put on Buddha of Suburbia. I actually use one of the instrumental tracks as the background for my trailer. Put on Buddha of Suburbia and it will blow you away. It is probably his most underrated album. And I say that because nobody knows about it. Nobody knows.
Right.
It's absolutely fantastic.
So let's talk about your movie and what spurred you. You kind of mentioned what spurred you to make this, but what spurred you to make it and what spurred you to make it about this stage of his career?
Well, again, it was always my favorite, starting with Tin Machine. I felt Tin Machine was grossly criticized, unfairly criticized, and people just didn't get it. They didn't want to see Bowie within the confines of the context of a band. And I kind of get that. But then you go into Black Tie, White Noise, which was the album after Tin Machine 2. And that's where he began, you know, really becoming himself. And it was just always my favorite era. Now, this is how this project started. I talk about Bowie on my show a lot. On the Bone, I'm the Bowie fanatic. I'm the crazy kid that loves Bowie. And a lot of people would ask me, what is it about Bowie that you love so much? And it came to me that a lot of people, again, don't know after Let's Dance what he did. So I was just going to collect some of my favorite performances that I knew. I had initially the first cut, had some movie clips from The Hunger, from Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence in it.
Yeah.
And it was almost, it was basically going to be a fanboy film.
Gotcha.
And is often with filmmaking and even songs, and you being a musician and songwriter as well, you'll know this. You start out somewhere and then the song or the film or the narrative will make itself known and say, I know this is what you were thinking, but what about this? What about going around this corner? So as I started putting it together with my editor, Spike, I said, this can be more. I didn't know if I had the resources and the time to do the research and everything. I initially told Spike, I'll pay you. It'll be 2 weeks worth of work. It's going to be an hour.
Right.
6 months later, an hour and a half, an hour 45 is where we ended up. I said, okay, this can actually be something that answers. I wanted something in between Moon Age Daydream and the last 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
I said, this could actually be that body of work, something to bridge Moon Age Daydream and the last 5 years. I scrapped a lot of the things from the beginning, and I said, okay, here we go. There were a couple of clips I knew that had to be in there. His reworking of Loving the Alien, which I think he did in 2002 with Jerry Leonard, and transformed it into a completely different song. It's such a touching performance that a lot of people haven't seen. That's why I called it Loving the Alien, because I wanted to open up with that song. There was another clip of his 50th birthday concert. And you're talking to a cat. I right here and right here are two crates, beer and Pepsi crates of LPs. I have all of his works on vinyl. I'm a vinyl cat.
Right.
I have all of his works on vinyl. There's a 50th birthday concert where he had various artists come in and perform different songs throughout his career. And there is a song called Hollow Space Boy, where Dave Grohl of the Foo Fighters is on drums, his guy is on drums, and then the original Foo Fighters drummer. It's a three friggin' drum assault.
It's insane, yeah.
yeah. You know, it's,
yeah.
And I wanted to introduce people to those kind of hidden clips and how funny he was. And the fact that he was on stage with Gilmore with Comfortably Numb. He was on stage singing Hurt with Trent Reznor, which leads, there's a clip that I have of him on stage with Arcade Fire. It was one of his last performances. It may have been, you know why he stopped touring, right?
I'm not really, because he had the heart attack and then it was his health, right?
During the reality tour, he was in Germany and he had a heart attack on stage. He started to, you can see he's standing and he's singing and he's grabbing his arm. He's grabbing his left arm.
Yeah.
And there's footage of this on the internet. Somebody in the crowd. And I struggled, Chris. I struggled in telling the story, because it's rare, with adding it to the documentary. But it's so, as a fan, it's so painful to watch. And this is no hyperbole. The 2.5 minutes of it, it hurt my heart. It hurt my heart to see this guy having a heart attack on stage. And I said, that's going to kill the documentary. All of the joy in the songs that you hear up to and whatever you see afterwards is going to all be overshadowed by this moment. Now it's real. And as a filmmaker, I'm a huge fan of real. I just didn't feel that it needed that. But what I did fit in a clip of one of his final performances, might have been his second to last, where after he had stopped touring, and I think he was on stage possibly 4 years later with Arcade Fire, and he did a song with them. And I had initially had it on the back end of the video because, let me tell you this, never do a project with somebody that doesn't get it. In other words, my editor, Spike, not a Bowie fan. He kept, the only song he knows by Bowie is Let's Dance. And he kept going, what are we going to put Let's Dance in? What are we gonna put? I go, we're not putting Let's Dance in. That's not the point of this. Stop asking me with Let's Dance.
The thing too, like the heart attack was addressed in the 5 years of last 5 years documentary. So you see that, right?
Absolutely. So I didn't need to research that ground, and the clip of him performing with the Arcade Fire, I think works better. Also the thing with that video with the heart attack, it's just kind of personal. It's just kind of like, you feel like a voyeur.
It was weird to me too, Maurice, not to interrupt you, but it's funny because you see, they talk about this tour and it starts with like this triumphant Bowie's tour. I think it was 2000, like you mentioned, it was at the Heathen tour.
Yeah.
And he's, like you mentioned, he's not wearing any crazy costumes, but he looks cool. And then the heart attack one, he's got like a hoodie on. It's like, I've never seen him looking like a roadie on stage before. And I was like, was he starting to like, not care, or was he getting warnings that maybe I just never, that I didn't like seeing that clip, obviously, because here's one of our heroes, no pun intended, having a heart attack. But he also didn't look like Bowie. Like Bowie always had a little bit of class. Even when you see in your documentary some of those later performances where he's wearing just a t-shirt and like jeans, it still looks
absolutely big. He looks great.
He looks cool. Like you could go to the club looking like that.
Absolutely.
The one where he had the heart attack, he looked like he was going to a high school football game. And I was just like, I wonder if there was a correlation there, either subtly or you know, I don't know. Just to me, it's like that whole thing just feels out of sorts.
I've often wondered, I mean, you know, this is a guy that clearly had access to all of the doctors in the world. Did he not know? Did he ignore signs? I mean, listen, he was on stage for the better part of 50 years, so I kind of get that. But it was odd to me that it would creep up on him. But true to his nature, you've seen the clip. He's like 2 minutes in telling people he's in pain. And then at some point they bring him a stool and he keeps pushing and pushing and pushing. And I don't know, you know, like we all are, and it's all our own business. We're all searching for something that people think we have or have already found. And they just don't understand that we may have bits and pieces of it, but we're ultimately not going to stop till we feel we have the completion of it, which sadly may never come, you know?
Well, let's talk to you about the stuff you did include. So I thought it was interesting because I didn't know what to expect.
Right.
Basically, you have done a great job, and I say stringing only because in amassing, collecting, sewing, all of these great performances together to make up this documentary. And there's not really a lot of interviews or talking with Bowie. There's some great bits, but mostly it's just you're swinging from amazing performance and amazing song. Honestly, I don't think I've ever heard Space Boy. I'm sure that I have, but watching with Foo Fighters with three drummers, I was like, what?
Right?
What is this? This is insane. It's amazing.
Right?
So how did you get all these clips? And obviously, Bowie's estate is not listening to this, and if they are, give me a call. I'm assuming you're not getting the licenses to use all of this stuff from the Conan O'Brien show, et cetera, et cetera.
No, right. It's interesting. I did the research going through everything that's on the internet. I mean, if you're going to do a documentary, there's no other way to do it if you don't have exclusive rights to unaired material or anything, but to do the internet. There is something called, and you're going to put me on the spot, it's called, because Lionsgate, I showed a friend of mine the trailer, and he's a musician, he's kind of dialed in with a lot of people, and he goes, I have a friend that works at Lionsgate that would be interested in this. And I said to him, because my intent was, and my intent still is, I said, I was putting this together and I was going to release it on the internet for free, which I'll get into that a little later. Just put it up on a site, Vimeo, then just allow people to see it for free. So I wasn't concerned necessarily about copyrights or the estate coming after me, because this was a labor of love to me.
Yeah.
I didn't make any money on it. As a matter of fact, I had to pay my editor, so I actually spent money on it. That's all it's ever been. Me saying, I'm a filmmaker, and David Bowie is my biggest inspiration. Why in the hell would I not make a film about it? But it's called fair use. The fair use doctrine will allow you in situations like this to compile, because you have to understand, everything I got off the internet.
Wow.
And it's all there without anybody's permission as well. Now, I had to do deep dives. In other words, it would take you a long time to pull every clip that I got. But the other thing is, Chris, and you mentioned how great the performances are, there are multiple performances of these songs that I put up there. Not all of them, but some. And you have to sit there and you have to look at the performances and you have to go, well, this one's better because of this reason. This one is going to hold people's interest more, because ultimately the goal of it is not for you and I. It's for you and I in the sense that there's a catch-all of some very great performances from David Bowie, and we've got those years explained.
Right.
But I also wanted to really pull people in that were not fans of David Bowie, or as JP of Roger and JP, who are also on the Bone, said, I was a very fringe fan, and you made me a believer. But that's how I got around. Now, listen. That's not to say that the Bowie estate not going to come after me, but I would think that they would look at it and go, well, it's all out there anyway. In other words, everything that I have in there, I stitched together into a narrative thread,
right,
which was really the directing part of it. Because it's like a friend asked me, well, how are you the director if you didn't shoot any footage? I go, well, what I'm doing is I'm directing traffic. I'm saying, I want this here. I want this here. Here are the transitions that I want. Cut this part out. Elongate this. Freeze frame this. So it's all out there. But I was able to, I hope successfully, and I've watched it a couple of times, and I do think that I was, but it's not for me to say. I think I was successfully able to put interviews in front of songs, put the songs and performances in a certain order that makes it seem like this was the trajectory of his life, and he knew that this was how it was going to go, and he said these things for that very purpose, for a document of those albums and that career.
So I was going to ask you, too, like, when you're getting these clips, there's so many times when you'll see, you know, this is not a fan documentary or a student documentary, but the clips the quality won't be as good because you're pulling off the internet. But the quality of these performances are all very good. Are they all out there at high definition, or how are you able to do that?
Well, we had to try and bolster some of the definition of some of the videos. But now understand something. Again, part of the process, part of the filmmaking of it, if you will, is going over footage and footage and footage and footage and seeing where the highest definition quality clips were. I'll be honest with you. There are songs that I wanted in here. There are performances that I wanted in here, and the quality was just not there. It was either shot by someone in the crowd, or it was just like too degraded. And that was the disheartening part, especially when there are a couple of songs that I know would have fit beautifully in there and people would have loved. But that's what it is. But thank you. I appreciate that compliment as far as the quality of the video, because that was a concern of mine. I didn't want someone watching this documentary as a whole and go, well, I could have spent a couple of weeks on YouTube and eventually I would have saw all of this stuff. Mm-hmm. And that might be true, but you're certainly not going to have the story aspects of it. You're not going to have the connectivity of it. You're not going to know that Bowie's Jump, they say, was written because of his half-brother's suicide. You're not going to understand those things. You're not going to have, you know, there were certain things I put in just for the humor of it, like the Ricky Gervais shit. Because it's just so, but Bowie, he could come off as a little bit snobby, stuck up, erudite, if you will. And to see him goofing off, it was just like the funniest thing to me.
So that's one thing that, like, I know this because once again, I'm a Bowie fanatic, disciple, whatever you want to say. Bowie is super funny. Like, he's funny. Like, he could be in the Beatles in the 60s. He's Lennon McCartney, dry sense of humor, funny. And if you haven't seen it, so Ricky Gervais, I'm a huge fan of all of his stuff.
Oh, absolutely.
He did a show called Extras. And it's just, you know, typical. He's just a sad sack. Everything he does is just a sad sack. And he meets Bowie. in a club. And of course, he's telling them, like, you know, in a show and the 6 million viewers, like in that classic Ricky Gervais, like putting himself over, but in the most embarrassing of ways.
Right. And Bowie won't buy it.
Bowie doesn't buy it. But then Bowie starts writing a song about the silly little fat man who should blow his stupid brains out. And he's got the piano and he's like, pig face, little loser. Everyone's singing with me now. Pig face, little loser. And Gervais is just sitting there, just eating it. And even the friend that's with him, the pretty Scotch girl, starts laughing. He's like, shut up. And Bowie's like, this is so funny. I almost wish like Bowie starred in a rom-com, like some kind of English, like get rid of Hugh Grant and put Bowie in there. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. And now that has nothing to do with the music, but it's an aspect of his life that you otherwise wouldn't get. And I desperately wanted to put that in. When he's telling the story of when he brings Dave Gilmore over,
that's
and goes,
great.
Yeah, my parents, six or seven. I was about six or seven. And then you look at David Gilmore's face and he pauses for a moment and goes, six or seven? I think not.
Yeah, he doesn't quite get it at first because Bowie's playing so straight. Basically what happens is another great moment that I think I'd heard about it, but Bowie actually performed with not just Gilmore, with Pink Floyd.
And right.
They did Comfortably Numb with Bowie on vocals. And like, I think it was Nick Mason says, like, he basically changed it into,
a
Bowie song.
Yeah. He turned it into a David Bowie song.
This great show of the rehearsal and doing it. And then backstage, he pulls Gilmore and says, you know, I was a Pink Floyd fan when my parents came and took me to see you, I think at the London Marquee when I was six or seven. And it was such a great experience. And he doesn't even like, no smile. And Gilmore is listening. And after a second, he's like, six or seven. Oh, I could have got my, I think you got your age wrong. Yeah, it was 10. Yeah. It was 10.
I think you exaggerated the age a little bit.
And the other great one, and it's such a Martin Short SCTV, but it's all English comedy, Canadian comedy, is when he's, I'm assuming it's probably from a behind the scenes interview from Extras where he's like, oh yeah, I gave Gervais some great material. Like years ago, and was like, you know, you and what army?
Yeah.
Like that was a good one.
Huh?
Or like, good, you know, if you keep making that face, it's going to stay that way. You know, it's just really funny. So, I recorded that David Gilmore and sent it to Rich Ward, the guitar player in Fozzy, because he's a Gilmore fanatic. And I was like, you got to see this. It's like the meeting of our two idols, and Bowie's just blistering him.
Right. That's what I want there. And I wanted all of that in one body of work, because I think it's important enough to have him out there and have it out there like that, where you don't have to search for, where it's still in some context, because I kind of do a progression of him aging, starting with Tin Machine. And I didn't go in exact order. There's one performance that is on an album that's outside of that era, and I don't know if you caught it or not. It was the song, the performance to Absolute Beginners. But at that performance of Absolute Beginners in that music hall is so brilliant, and that is such a unique song in his canon.
Yeah.
I just really wanted to have it in there, and I justified it by going, well, the performance of it is within the framework of the years that I'm talking about. And then the other one was Heroes on the End. But this is the thing. You can't do a documentary, regardless of what the area is, I don't think. You can't do a documentary about Bowie and not have Heroes. That's like doing a documentary on Bruce Springsteen and not having Born to Run in it somewhere. You know, that's his signature song. What did you think? Did you think it was poignant, speaking of Heroes, when him and his daughter were playing the little keyboards together?
I thought that was amazing. And once again, I don't know where you found that clip. It was so
Chris,
well.
I was doing the work.
But no, I mean, you really got some great stuff there. And once again, this awesome clip of Bowie playing a toy piano with his little girl. And I was just like, this is really good stuff. Between that and like some of the humorous stuff, like that to me is what I really enjoyed.
Thank you.
Beyond just the performances and beyond, once again, every look Bowie has is just different. He's got long hair. He's got short hair.
Right?
I forgot about the long hair Bowie, which was fairly recent too in his career, you know?
I thought that was the coolest Bowie, the long, where he had to keep sweeping it out of his
face. Yeah.
That's rock and roll right there, brother.
I imagine it would be hard to do a documentary. Well, not hard for me to do a documentary because I've produced a couple documentaries, but to me it's based on it's happening right now.
Right.
We're getting, you know, interviews with the participants because we don't know where it's going to go. I mean, I did one a couple of years ago called I'm Too Old for This Shit, where a band found out that they had a huge fan base in Germany 30 years after they broke up, and they were getting a chance to go to Germany and finally play there. It's a real true story about a band, actually a Tampa band called Siren, But it was happening as it was going. And I said, either this is going to be a huge bomb or it's going to be one of the greatest feel-good stories that you could do. With yours, Bowie's done. His career is done. His life is over. So you're now constructing this out of footage that already exists.
Correct.
Which to me would seem almost even more difficult than doing a documentary, because you only have so much material to play with.
And understanding, again, what is necessary and what is not. Now, I think you know that there were songs that I didn't play in their entirety. There were performances where I cut in. I knew, like, the song Slip Away, which I really love, which is a really plaintive song. There is just a point where if you're trying to draw other people in, give them 3 minutes of it. I cut that song in half. I came in 3 minutes in, and then other ones I tailed off on the end. So it's about knowing the temperament that the documentary, the piece of work should have. And so that was difficult. But ultimately, it was just extremely rewarding to me. And that's without me having put it out there yet. And we're going to send it to the festivals and we're going to see what we can do. But ultimately, I just want people, because I'm a part of a couple of David Bowie fan groups on Facebook that have, you know, fairly sizable followings. I mean, you know, and they're not doing what Chris Jericho's doing. but give them time. Give them time. And I'm gonna post up the link for them for a week, and then I'm gonna shut it down, and then we're gonna submit it to the festivals, and I'll see what Liongate is wanting to do with it, if they can do anything. If they can't, the completion of it and the project itself, you know, again, I'll repeat it, you know, sometimes the journey is the destination, and the journey of it was what was cool. What do you remember where you were when you found out he died?
Yeah, because I had just bought in Blackstar. I remember I was in Los Angeles and Blackstar came out, and I was like, because remember, people might not remember, they just dropped it. Like, there is no warning of this album. It's just like a new Bowie record. How the hell did nobody know about this?
And then, they did that with The Next Day. The Next Day came out, and it's like, what? He's got an album? Because he had went underground.
Right. And he had his guys, you know, his producer, Tony Visconti, and his magicians that he'd been with for years. They all signed NDAs. And somehow, you know, nobody noticed Bowie walking into a freaking studio for 2.5 months every morning in New York. But whatever. So I remember reading that. And once again, Maurice, did the record come out and he died the next day or vice versa?
If I'm not mistaken, he died and the record was released the next day. I'm almost certain of that, but you've got something in front of you that can corroborate it. But I would be very surprised if I was wrong. The record came out the day after he died. They talked about his death in the morning. I remember it was on Good Morning America. And that's when I first learned of it.
So it came out January 8th and Bowie died January. No, it came out first. He died on the 10th.
Oh, it did. Okay.
So, yeah.
Okay.
And that's what I remember. So and this now it all makes sense to me.
Gotcha.
I bought Blackstar. I remember I did this show, if anyone's ever seen it, because they talk about it on Twitter all the time, a show called The Thundermans. And it was like a kids' TV show on the Disney Channel, and they called me to do some role as one of the parents.
Oh, wait, I know the
I got a mullet in it. And I remember going to the studio and listening to Blackstar and getting into it. Because once again, it's not, I didn't know what to expect. You know, it's weird and it's slow and it's like haunting. And it's like, what the hell is this? It's fast, it's slow. And then it was a day later when you find out like that Bowie passed away. And I was like, this is so crazy. I was really tight with Lemmy. Lemmy had his 70th birthday party at the Whiskey. I think he was diagnosed with cancer 2 days later and died like a week and a half after that. Like it was quick.
Right, yeah,
he was
yeah.
like, I'm not playing this shit. I'm taking myself out of the game. We're done. And almost like Bowie is like, I'm just going to wait until the record comes out. You know, you hear about that sometimes, like people wait for a wedding or they wait for to see their daughter get married or something.
Right.
And as soon as that happens, they're gone. I really think he was waiting for that and made a couple really haunting videos as the blind prophet, Button Eye. And then he was gone. And it was just like, wow, like, listen, none of us, you know, we're all here with the same destination of we're someday not going to be.
Right.
But that's a pretty freaking cool, those two examples of Bowie and Lemmy, that's pretty cool way to go. Like, you know, like, man.
Yeah. Well, Lemmy, you know, I mean, as much as a badass as Bowie in his own respect, in his own right, Motorhead, they don't get the credit that they deserve.
Agreed.
I think you're, again, and I mentioned this, but I think you're absolutely right as well. to be able to write your own epitaph, to be able to do videos
yes.
that show you dying in bed and you expressing these thoughts through this beautifully haunting music. I mean, forget about it. I know that I was laying on my couch downstairs, like I get up early and I'll go down and I'll turn on the news. And then it came on and I just laid on the couch and I just thought about it for a little bit. And then I was like, okay, well, we are in a Bowie-less world now. I did not shed a tear, Chris, until maybe a week later. My daughter called me and she's in New York. She's doing news up in New York. And she was maybe 30 at the time. And she said, I was just remembering how many moments from my childhood involved David Bowie, because I watched her during the day because I was doing stand up at night and her mother would work. So it was her and I from the time we got up till about 5 p.m. You know, and we're in the car and it's Bowie this, it's Bowie that. And, you know, I would just show her all of this stuff. And when she said, I forgot how many of my moments were attached, had David Bowie attached to it, then I realized that it wasn't just about me, that he was glue between my daughter and myself at a very critical time in our life. And that's when I you know, I'm a man, Chris. I'm not saying I shed it. I said, I welled up a little bit. I got a little bit misty, Chris.
Let's talk about some of the performances here that you've included. What are some of your favorites? We mentioned Hello Space Boy. That's really powerful. It's very metal.
Right.
You have a great video from Tin Machine, Under the God, which they played the shit out of that. I grew up in Winnipeg in Canada because Bowie was very popular in Winnipeg, as he was everywhere. But I remember Tin Machine. I hadn't heard that song in a while. I was like, man, I got to go back and revisit that. But what are some of your favorite performances that you included in this?
Tin Machine, absolutely. Hello, Space Boy with the Foo Fighters. I mean, that's, you know, there's just no denying the power of that.
Yeah.
But I'll be honest with you, one of my favorite songs is Jump, They Say. That's one of my favorite clips. And the only reason, Chris, I didn't do a live performance of that is because I think the subtleties and the nuances in the music, the horn playing, the female voices that are coming in the background when he says, got to believe in somebody. I think it's one of his best. It's one of my favorite clips. But if we go live, you know, again, I'm going to say to you that I really love the opening track, Loving the Alien. And if I had directed Moon Age Daydream, that's how I would have closed that film. Mm. Because it's so eerie. The phrasing is such a great metaphor for his life and the people that loved him or that were trying to understand why they should love him. I just think it's one of the more powerful performances. But I got to be honest with you. I mean, how do you not love Little Wonder, which is a fantastic song? How do you not love Dead Man Walking? But if yet, my top three performances, I would say Loving the Alien, Hollow Space Boy with the Foo Fighters. Since it wasn't a performance, I might have to go with Epps. Oh, man, Never Get Old. I forgot. Yeah. Never Get Old. All right. And to be honest with you, we start with the video of Thursday's Child, but then we transition into the live version of it, which has always been a favorite song. Okay, Never Get Old, Loving the Alien, and Hollow Space Boy.
So many choices, right?
Yeah. I forgot about Never Get Old.
Well, like you said, Little Wonder comes across great. I loved Earthling on Conan as well, you know. And
yeah, absolutely. It just as far as a performance goes, and Reeves Gabrel on the guitar and him, early on, the voyeur of utter destruction is beauty. Damn, who directed this documentary? He did a really good job, Chris.
So, Maurice, as we start to wind down here, what are your plans for the documentary and what would you like to see happen with it? Because obviously it's a labor of love. You're so excited to be doing it.
Absolutely.
And us Bowie fanatics, like, I just loved watching. I had to kind of rush through it to get it done by the time you and I talk, but I'm going to watch it again so I can really, because even the end credits, there's a Heroes performance from Glastonbury.
Absolutely, which is fantastic. And please,
yeah,
after the credits, there is a performance that I couldn't fit in of them playing This Is Not America, which he says he never plays. Did you already see? Did you get to that?
I saw that at the end, but then I had to, but I know they played. What year was that? 2000?
Oh, that was about 2000, right. Of course, from that 1984 film with Sean Penn and Timothy Hutton.
Oh, yeah.
The Falcon and the Snowman. Remember that? The true life story about the kids that turned into spies for Russia. Yeah. And I couldn't fit it in because it wasn't in the framework of the time, but it's such a fascinating performance that I wanted it somewhere to die. So it's kind of like an album's hidden track, you know?
Yeah, of course.
And so my end goal is, but before I do that, because I don't want you to come up before I get to say this about Fozzie, because I wanted to, obviously, we're going to be talking about music. And, you know, I want to give you the respect of, you know, knowing about your music. Obviously, I knew you were in Fozzie. I had not done a deep dive on it. I'm not telling you I did a deep dive. Mm-hmm. I did what I felt was a somewhat comprehensive overview of the work, which, and first and foremost, you guys are fantastic. Fantastic. Now, going beyond the first two records where they were covers, what I found, this is what I took from Fozzie. You guys do the hard brilliantly. You have that there. But what you'll find in a heavy metal, a hard rock band, is that their chops are put on display more when they slow down.
Yes.
So if you go Chasing the Grail, I'm going to take Broken Soul, which I think you guys know that was a fantastic song because you I think it was like the second or third single from that album. Go Sin and Bones, A Past Life is phenomenal.
Wow, thanks, man.
But one of my favorite from Do You Want to Start a War? And by the way, reading up on a lot of people were saying Sins and Bones was the record. For me, Do You Want to Start a War? That's the one. Not only with Do You Want to Start a War, but with Bad Tattoo, which is a fantastic fucking metaphor for a relationship that you can't get the stink up off of. But Scarecrow, you guys, when you slow down, and I don't know if you know Steven Wilson and a band called Porcupine Tree.
Yeah.
It's really on a past life. You guys get that ethereal ambient, those kind of textures in there and your voice. And when you bring that voice down, it reminded me of Porcupine Tree, which is one of my favorite bands.
Interesting.
Yeah. And I just thought that was where I said, okay, obviously I can appreciate the crunch. But if you're able to slow down and make me appreciate going through a certain journey with you that may not necessarily attack me, and I have to sit there and I have to listen, I think you guys are legit. Same, by the way, man, that's, forget about it. That's boombox. That's boombox, right?
That's boombox.
Okay,
yeah. That's boombox.
Okay, yeah. You're legit, dude. And I wanted to be able to tell you that, because the thing is, you go, all right, he's wrestling, he's going to try and rock. And then you listen to you feel like you're going to listen to the music and be like, okay. It's like when a band goes away for a long time and then they come back and you're like, and you're going to interview them and you're like, but then I was pleasantly surprised with Extreme, who after 15 years came back with Rise Up, which is, wow. I was like, oh, this guy is legit.
Well, once again, that comes from the Bowie attitude of you always want to evolve, you know what I mean, and always change things up.
Why did you not start out as a singer? Obviously, you have got a voice. You've got a songwriting skill.
No, I've been playing in bands since I was 13 years old. I wanted to be in a rock band and I wanted to be a wrestler, and they both kind of happened at different times. So.
Okay, fair enough.
But once again, yeah. So, but going back to Loving the Alien.
Well, another question before that, and I know I'm interviewing you. Did you ever think of being a rocker and smashing people over the head in the ring?
No, because that's cheesy. That's cheesy. You don't mix the two, because then people don't take one seriously or the other.
They take either one seriously. I got it.
Yeah, exactly. You don't want to make a mockery of it, because everyone always used to say that. Are you body slam guys on stage? Yeah, that's exactly what I do. Our stage set is a giant ring, and I take bumps in the ring while I'm singing, because that's legit.
Put their head through a Marshall stack.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah. I'll leave that up to Manowar.
You're smart. You're a smart man, Chris. Go ahead. What did you want to say?
Let's finish up with Loving the Alien, though, man. Once again, it's a great piece of work. Obviously, you put a lot of time and effort into it. I mean, how long did it take for you to make this, by the way?
Half a year. And now when I say half a year, that's over the course of, sometimes we would only be able to sit down for a week or so. But again, it was constantly evolving. My wife,
right.
I told my wife no less than four times it was done. And we kind of got into an argument because I was like, oh, there's this cut that I really think I need to make. And, it's taking up time from me and the baby and giving her free time. And she's like, I thought you said it was done. And I had to say to her, I go, I have to be honest with you. I've never been in a relationship where I've had to justify creating.
Right, right, right.
I think of something that I create and I just kind of want to be left alone until I'm done. I go, the project's done when the project's done. and you know, now you can over tinker with it. At some point you have to let it go. But every change that I went back and made only made the project better. So I knew that my instincts were correct. So yeah, about half a year plus the time thinking about it, plus the time, you know, gestating on it. And we'll see what happens. Like I say, I want to submit it to festivals. I'm going to let people see it for a week, and then I'm going to shut it down, and then we'll see what happens with the festivals.
Last two questions for you. What's your favorite scene or part of the documentary?
I would have to say it's him playing the little tiny keyboard with his daughter. If it's not him playing the little tiny keyboard with his daughter, again, I go back to that first performance of Love and the Alien that I think is so beautifully reworked and so sad. I would say one of those two. Aside from the humorous parts.
Yeah. I love the Gilmore part, but I think my favorite performance, you mentioned a few times, but you guys got to check it out, is Hollow Space Boy, which is from his 50th anniversary at Madison Square Garden, which I'm sure there's a whole many videos of that on YouTube, which I'm going to check out. But just the fact he had three drummers on stage.
Oh, I mean.
That's got such a chance of being a total train wreck, but those guys came in and it was great.
Right. And believe it or not, the 50th anniversary concert, there's not a lot of footage out there with that. I have it on a double album, but I think it was kind of bootlegged.
Oh, wow.
I don't know.
But yeah. That's great, man. Yeah. Last question. What's your favorite Bowie song or album of all time?
Again, I'm going to go with Outside, which is from 95, which is the double LP. I apologize about Mr. Pause, which is a complex album about a serial killer. There's a song on there called I'm Deranged, which is just phenomenal. And if you have not heard it, and there's no footage that was good enough for me to use to put that song in there. David Lynch used it for his Lost Highway film. And you know, David Lynch is, he's like crazy. So if you know, it's good. It's good. I'm Deranged. I compel you to go ahead and look at that. That would be one of them. I just think The Beauty of Absolute Beginners is fantastic as well, too. So I would say those. But my favorite album is Outside. Black Tie, White Noise is in there as well. And if you learned anything from me, if you're taking anything away from this, buy a copy of Buddha of Suburbia. And when you've got 45 minutes, because it flows like that, when you've got 40 minutes, it's probably 40 minutes, put the headphones on and don't let anybody interrupt you. And you're going to be so upset with yourself that you wasted so many years without
not knowing it. Yeah.
Yes.
No, I feel that way about Hollow Space Boy, man. I got to tell you that. Yeah.
Yes. Outside is an album that you need. That's when he got back with Brian Eno. You're a musician. Yeah. You know how important Brian Eno is and how revolutionary he is. I would say Buddha of Suburbia and Outside are two albums that you need to listen to front to back, and you'd be surprised. There's so much more than Hollow Space Boy on Outside, but Hollow Space Boy is the fucking highlight.
Well, dude, I know you got to get on the air, and great meeting you, even though you're just only about 20 minutes from me right now, but great piece of work. Congratulations, man. And
thank you.
Hopefully I'll get a chance to do your show face-to-face one of these days.
I would love to. You'll be around. And listen, I was told by your assistant that you're about to do some touring and this and that. I appreciate you taking the time to squeeze me in. I really do. I really do, Chris. I look forward to meeting you in person. And thank you for this.
Absolutely, man. Thanks, Maurice. Appreciate it, man.
Thank you, brother.